So I wanted to hi, I'm Nellie. I'm in recovery, and I wanted to tell my story. A couple of months ago, I was going to tell it from the vantage point of a person who was really sad, and I've been working through a lot of things. So I think I might I might start from the sunshine and just all of the amazing things that recovery affords me, like a lot of curiosity and a lot of lack of rigid thinking. So yeah, let me see where where to start the story, because I could start it from like Friday night, just being at a sex club where it seems like everybody was less happy than I was because I'm in recovery and because things are okay. I'll start where I always start. When I was 14 years old, I ran with a really bad crowd, sorry, good crowd of bad girls. And I was really in love with them. And they were always trying to do things that were sneaky and fantastic. And so there's this big hill in my town, and it was a wild place where there was at one point a 6 foot wolf, like a wolf that at its, like at its shoulder stood 6 feet, that used to ravage the land and steal babies from farmhouses. And there was an old mansion, the Governor Smith mansion, and people in the 70s might have like performed satanic sacrifices there, and it had like this whole spooky thing. And I used to escape with my friends up on this mountain like all the time, and we would plot our ways of breaking into the world. And so those girlfriends decided that the way to really act like adults was to find the world of drugs and alcohol. And so I was younger than they were. I was in grade 7, they were in grade 8. This is, I was like 14. Yeah, we were all about 14. But so they wanted to go to these frat boy parties, these Greek parties, whatever, with like really older guys. And this is something about like growing up in the country is we had a club, a teen club, and like there'd be like way too old men there, and we'd find ways of like spiking the punch or what have you. We thought this was very, very adult. And so I went to one of like a party where people were drinking when I was really young, and I wasn't allowed to read a book, and my mom is a children's librarian, and instead of like drinking, I read The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer from the Twin Peaks series, like a trashy novel that you could get in the grocery store or something. And because I read this sexy book, I was like I was grounded. And I told my mom, well, people were drinking at this party, and I did something that that disobeyed my mom. So I got grounded for reading instead of drinking. So I went, wow, I'm totally allowed to drink. I didn't realize, like, I have total complete permission to drink. So I'd go to these parties with these beautiful girls, and I think that I could somehow protect them because I was that member of the friend group that, it was like these friends at all costs, and I thought that I could protect them from guys getting into them. So I would go to these parties, and I would like get a beer, and I would empty it out, and I would then like very publicly be drinking this beer so that I looked like I was as drunk as my friends. And then I would be able to like be in the same room with them, or be able to be like, just keep them from guys. But then after a bunch of alcohol, my girlfriends didn't want me around them to be protecting them from the attention of like way older fellas. And so that just made me go, okay, well, fine. I'll just drink too. So we were trying to pretend to be way older than we were, and it suddenly became like that's where it kind of clicked for me. That was my like alcohol was a way into being able to be sexy and free and rebellious. And like I thought I kind of had permission. So like we'd go over to my folks' place because my parents, as adult children of alcoholics, never drank and never had alcohol in the house, never touched their alcohol. So we of course did the take my mother like would make like Rendazaba or some like you know something with rum or something with vodka, or we'd entertain people from all over the world. And so we had like liquor in the liquor cabinet, and my girlfriends and I like you know totally did the rum and water replacement of the vodka. And I want to say like you know just how buttoned up my society was that I was 27 when my mom found me out. I was 14 at the time that I stole the vodka. I was 27 when they noticed the vodka was missing. Like when it was like, you know, so watered down with water. So then about the same age, my mother being a librarian, we went to Children's Literature England. And my elder sister was going to be living in Scotland, and I got to go and check things out for her and like meet my mom and drive up the UK into Scotland to where my sister was going to be living. She fell in love with an exchange student at summer camp. You know how people love camps. I've heard that one. And so we went to Children's Literature England, and I went to the uni club. I had my big adventures, but people who were teenagers like I was in Scotland were drinking. Like we were drinking everywhere, but it's really hard in the States. In the States, you have to be 21 to get alcohol, so you have to be with people who are like way older, and they're really strict about it. And like you have to do sort of favors for shoulder tapping, as my girlfriends would. And like shoulder tapping means like standing outside of a place and getting some alcohol that way. So I go to this club with these family members of the boy that my sister's in love with in Scotland. And we get there to the door, like the bouncer at the door is like, you know, asking like, am I 18? And I say, no, I'm 19. I walk right in, and my friends are just like, oh, I thought you were 14. And I was like, no, I just say that because I have a boyfriend back in the States. And like, I just don't want him to get jealous. So I just tell people I'm way underage. They're like, yeah, totally sorted. Totally, like I was being so amazing. So I get to the club, and it's really, really grand. And I drink some terrible, like as the kids in the hall would say, like girl drink drunks, you know, these like blue balls, like Curacao, nasty kinds of things. But then somebody gets me some ecstasy because it's a club. And suddenly, like everything is like a brand new level of just whole wildness. And around that time, I think, you know, all of my friends were older. Everybody was sort of like filing into this like worldly, I don't know, like terrible house and club music and things like that. But I just felt like I was initiated into something so much older than I was. I just wanted to be older so badly. And so so that's when I started really sneaking out and really doing things. And like I was such a repressed good kid, that they would give me things like hall monitor jobs at my primary school and my elementary school, and like I would just sneak people out to get cigarette like so that they could smoke cigarettes, and I got to be like this badass, but I was also a child, so like I fell freaking in love with that, and that's like the world that drugs and alcohol opened up to me. Is like I was suddenly so. Everyone was so happy to see me because I was always holding, or I was, or like wherever the party was where I was. And while I was in high school in Ireland, they call it the fifth year, but it's you know junior year of high school, I fucked off to the West Coast, and because I wanted to be a journalist, and I wanted to go to the best public high school in the country to be a journalist, because what I wanted to do is I wanted to just collect people's stories, and and that's what I wanted to do. Like I was just like a very social and interested and bookish and awkward until I was like dancing and on drugs, and then everybody just wanted to be my friend. And so when I was on the West Coast, I sort of started, it was part of this like ring of clubs, and like I was like really like I wasn't old enough to be doing this kind of thing, but like there was a Saturday market in Eugene, and I was friends with all these people from the university, and I like if you needed acid, you could find me. Like that's much implication I'll give to myself. But I also was like kind of running this like mixtape DJ thing, like over mixtapes we would send, and we would just write magnetic media, do not X-ray, and somehow people were getting things from Minnesota to Oregon to all sorts of places like that. Yeah, so anyway, Oregon, a great place in the story. So I just was like a legend in my own mind, but it was because I was like fiercely lonely, and I wouldn't tell anybody what my age was. And so I would go and I'd get myself to some pretty dicey situations, pretty interesting situations, because I just wanted to be older and do fun things. And when my parents weren't around anymore, I could be pretty wild. And I wasn't in school for a while, and I was trying to get back into school, and I was working for the software company. Like, I just, like, I don't know, began the whole BFD sort of meltdown. but really at the center of that was, I liked people, and so I'd promote a lot of parties, and I'd be friends with all of these DJs and all of these collectives, and it all just seemed like some sort of grand utopia. I went back to graduate from high school, back to Vermont, and you know, I was kind of miserable because I couldn't be contained anymore, and so I led a really secret life of pain. but okay, then I went to school, and I could drink like a man, and I was very popular because I because I threw parties, and I and like, you know, everybody just kind of worshipped the idea of the fun never ending, and it was a very hard school, and too clever. And so I was just really dangerous stuff, but I never got caught for it. And I always was hanging out with people who seemed like they were much worse off. So I got to hide in that alcoholic niche. Like there were a couple of friends of mine from school who found the rooms. And of course I didn't want anything to do with them as they found the rooms, but they did extreme stuff. And I couldn't see that what I did as extreme as like what they would do, you know, they showed their pain a lot more on the surface than I. But then, you know, I had this fabulous career in college as somebody who could just like the party can keep going. And then when I graduated and like life began for everybody else, it didn't. And that failure, it didn't begin for me. And that failure to launch, and like, you know, I met my partner in the lesbian bar. You know, I was dancing in the lesbian bar, the Jonathan Richman song goes, and you know, also young and throwing parties, and I really didn't want this person to the person that I ended up with to be a man, but it ended up that way, and I was really like, you know, chasing his girlfriend at the time, but whatever, that's part of my story. That's more like, how do you get people intoxicated so that they'll make out with you? like, so that they'll shift you. So, like, you know, that's a pretty bad part of my history as well. Anyway, so, yeah, as I got older, it got less cute. And I was the only one who was still hanging around and still partying and still drinking like I'm a college student and still trying to cover up a lot of pain and a lot of disappointment. And like the limo never arrives. It was just one of those experiences where like, wait, my real life is about to begin and I'm about to be recognized for everything and it's all going to take off. And it never happened. And fear just increasingly kept taking the mic on my actions and on my life. Like, oh, I totally like wanted to quit so many times. And I, as performative as I am, was able to like, you know, just show people how like, you know, if I quit for a month, you definitely know about it, right? Or if I were giving up things or celebrating Shabbos, I don't know. It would just be nice and performative. And it would seem like I didn't have a problem. I just was in a bad relationship, or I was just, I was just getting a bum deal. And I really appreciate the expression, if you had my life, you'd drink too. Because that poor me, another, like that manipulation, like, I got so much free stuff for how pathetic I am. I really was able to work that one quite well. So much. Poor me, like, oh no, come over to my house, we'll drink a bottle of wine. Like, oh, that sounds awful. You just come sit by me, Nellie, and like, it'll all be grand. Because, you know, a part of my lonely childhood and my loneliness and my exceptionalism is just that it gets covered up, but it doesn't go away. I have like a fire in my head all the time. I just try to rage over it and like go bigger. And so as I like moved into my 20s and even 30s, this became such a not attractive portrait of a person anymore. I mean, used to be, you know, back in the day, I like to say this because it happened once at a party that people were lining up to hold my hair as I puked. Everybody was just like, you know, oh, it's also dancing queen, just glittery and lovely and legend in my own mind kind of thing. And I really appreciated it. And if you fast forward to the end of my drinking career, it had none of those glamorous or sexy or interesting aspects. It was just really the portrait of a pathetic person who was racing to the end of her day and disappointed when she wasn't dead. Just completely disappointed that all of the antics that I pulled, or all of the stuff, all of the bigness that I had, wasn't resulting in what I could do, which was to not be around anymore. And everything looked like that. Just racing to the end of the day was a little bit of a death. Like there was so much boredom. I drank because I was bored. I drank because I wasn't bored. You know, I drank because I was excited. But mostly like when I had a job that I cared too much about that wasn't getting me anywhere, I would just be like, okay, how do I figure out the circadian rhythms of how, how I can be just like on my, like in my best lecture mode by like 10 a.m. And if I like drink this much and I do this much and I do this kind of thing, then I will be able to pass out by 9 p.m. and I'll be able to wake up at 5. And, you know, that was a whole other story, like waking up when I can draw some of the portrait of it. But it would be dark I wasn't allowed to put my dog on a leash. I had to put in like a certain amount of time in my household in order to show that I wasn't, I don't know, an animal abuser. So I had to wake up at 4 and like walk my dog for an hour without a leash in the country where there were skunks and like cars and what have you, just by like vocal command in like snow, and the door would be locked on me, like when I left, so that I couldn't come in until a certain time passed. You know, those kind of control things. I mean, that's just like one little example. But I had I lived in a I lived under a lot of rules. Oh, and I drank over those too, because no matter what I did, I couldn't get out from under bad things that I'd done in the past. In my relationships, that's what happens when you get together with somebody when you're 20, 21. It's like they just don't forgive things that you did when you were 24, when you're 36. You know, like that's part of my problem, part of my whole cocktail of problems as well. So it got uglier, it got worse, and until finally, at the very end of all things, I was so like mentally unwell that finally I was getting some diagnoses for that, and I had a therapy animal, which was the most amazing thing. I advocate for anybody from their madness and their upset and their fear to be able to have that kind of experience and training and loveliness of having somebody who is helping me out through my days. But I ended my drinking career by trying to not exist anymore, and things were not going well in my relationship, and I had cut ties with my family, and I had no friends left because my former relationship didn't like my friends and didn't like my family. And I'm a very social person, and all I could do was just mess up, it seemed. And I've described this before to many people about how I was living. I mean, nobody would know. I lived in a place with lots of firearms and totally remote, like a real 10-minute drive to get to any food, and probably about a half an hour drive from a restaurant where I could eat. And I, you know, tended my gardens and put food by and made my own seitan of wheat, like wheat meat and whatever. Had all of these homesteading kind of things. It was nuts. It was nuts. I Kimmy Schmidt in the bunker for a while at the end. And I didn't even know that. Like, I didn't know that there were any other kinds of options. So I made my attempt to leave, because like for me, like the first, when you have no skills, no tools, like the first thing that you think is a pretty extreme reaction to a maybe figure outable situation. But for me, it just didn't seem that my parents and my former would stop fighting, and that I was sort of down the middle. And so I tried to do something. And then the next day, I went to a meeting because I was in graduate school, and there was this meeting in a barn. And there was an author that I really admired who was going to that meeting. And there were two people, three people in that meeting, in this meeting in a barn. And we read Just for Today, like maybe Step One or something, like in a 12 and 12, or like, and people told their stories. And I said my name, and the author was just like, "You know what? Like, what do your parents call you?" I'm like, "Nellie." And they're like, she said, "I like Nellie. Why don't you just be Nellie from now on?" And I'm like, "Okay, yeah, because those who have loved me have called me Nellie." So I gave up my like, you know, professional full name, which maybe people would know me by. And I started to I started to get better almost immediately because I didn't realize that there had been any other options. I didn't realize that there was a way of, well, I mean, come on, I am like everyone else. I thought, oh, nobody who's exciting doesn't drink. Nobody who is beautiful doesn't do drugs. Nobody who's fun is going, like, I don't want freaking Serenity. And I was actually like in a meeting in Cork the other day, well, a Zoom meeting in Cork the other day. And so it was like, I'm like, I want Serenity. And my girlfriend was like, no, you don't. Like, stop lying. No, you don't. That's not what you want. But you want to not drink today. It's like, yeah, you know, that's probably a little more accurate. So I found the rooms. And I cried my way into it. And there was this lovely woman there who said, you know what you do now? I'm like, no. Like, it's just like, you go to another meeting. And I went, what? Like, it was just this magical, like, little barn sort of scenario. It was like, I was cured, it's converted, right? So that was totally confusing for me. And so Julia brought me to this this meeting in downtown, like in downtown Middlebury, Vermont. And like, I didn't know, like, about, like, when they passed the hat, I was like, okay, this is some weird kind of tithing thing. And so I, like, put in like a 5 or a 10 or like, what do you, like, I have no idea, this church. So that was kind of funny as well. And then I started talking to this woman after the meeting, and it turned out that her mom had been the registrar of my tiny little college, and it turned out that she had owned a restaurant where I had worked, and it turned out that we had all of these, like, connections. And I'm like, this is so embarrassing. I can't be in a small place and be an alcoholic. And she's like, but I don't even know you. And, like, nobody knows you. It's not that small a place, like, if you're finding help. And she made me become, like, her sponsee that night. And I was like, well, what did this entail? And she said, you have to call me you have to call me at first. I'm like, when? And she's like, all the time. And she was like, whenever. Like, whenever you need me to call me. I'm like, okay, that's interesting. And she's like, you have to write 3 gratitude to me every night, or somebody's coming for you. And that was the most amazing feeling, I have to say, was when I was so low and so alone and desperate, and at the end, that somebody would say, if you don't write to me, there are going to be people who care about you. They're going to be people who want you to be okay, and they're going to come for you. So that was an extraordinary thing. And, like, I didn't even want to test it because I didn't want to be disappointed that someone wouldn't be coming to my house. So I became an incredible, dutiful soldier of recovery at that moment. I was like, okay. And my share was fantastic. She had been a bartender and a religious studies major, and so she was, like, really, like, she was just hardcore. She was punk, and she was a grandmother and like, didn't look like she was had the same insides that I did. She didn't look like she was somebody who had the kinds of pain. And, like, the exact same size pain that I had. And so I had been told by somebody in the program, like, you know, that your sponsors, like your mechanic, don't ask them for where you can get your hair done. They are just like your menu advisor. I mean, it's not a relationship where you have to feel like you are kowtowed or that you are desperate. As a friend of ours here in Chisora says, you've suffered enough, and there's no reason to, like, you know, suffer in recovery because you're not brave. You can't find or see sunshine or see things that were never uncovered before. So that was, it was really something, like share away in June, right before I left for Ireland this time. So it was essential that I had a connection no matter what, and like to be able to keep connection no matter what other, rely on the one person, which is part of my story in being, you know, like living in a bunker, right? To be, I mean, if I had done something that I considered shameful, she would say, "We do that." Or she'd say, if there's a name for it, if somebody else has done it, then we can figure it out. And at the like early recovery, I met some of the most beautiful women. I call them the women who raised me. Some of them, and some of them have mullets, and some of them have, like, you know, like other people might not see them as the most beautiful women in, who raised me, were like astounding. And I say all the time that I learned many things at Church of Stacy, and Stacy would tell you, like, never ever ever call what she says Church of Stacy. But this is where I first learned self-care, is when she would say, make it a thing. Like, you deserve some time to go to sleep. Make it a thing. Like, put yourself to bed. Give yourself some, like, lovely tea. Give yourself some lovely music. Give yourself the Golden Girls. Give yourself whatever you want that is just comfortable and safe and gorgeous. Is my audio okay? Marcia, is there something going on? You're okay. Anyway, so Stacy and I met at a treatment center for women in the town where I decided to move in recovery. Like, I decided to move to a town for recovery purposes, which was really cool. That I was looking at apartments, and Stacy like stopped her car and got out of the car and said, I see that you're on a phone call, Nellie, but I just want to make sure that you're okay. Never, like, I was talking to a friend, like, you know, in Boston or something like that. But I had never, someone just show me that kind of care. Like, you know, you probably get the superficial, like, are you all right? Like, how's it going? Or, like, you know, yeah, you probably get the, how's it going? But this woman, like, actually, like, checked on me. Like, recognized me as a person of recovery, and just like stopped and got out and went, like, what's up with you? And like, people showed an interest in me that I went, what? Like, you know, like, I thought that I was like this grand lover, and that I, like, you know, feel so deeply, and that I cared about people. But the more that like my sort of self-centered addiction was revealed to me, the more I realized that I just actually hadn't ever thought to get out of a car and like ask if somebody's doing okay, or like genuinely, like, you know, it seems like a superficial level that people want to make sure that I am okay, that I don't drink today, and that there's that my sobriety matters to them. That's like, okay. Unbelievable. I'm not very quick to trust on that one. But then I was just showed a kind of care and a kind of love and a kind of way of just a way of taking care of myself. And like, you know, little mantras like self-care is never selfish. Treat yourself like somebody who's really sick and like deserves to be like nurtured. How would you nurture your best friend? How would you treat someone? How would you treat yourself if you were very sick? And like, really, it's important to get better because there's something on the other side of you being sick. Like, how would you start to take all of that negative stuff, which really is sounded when you are playing and masking and trying to be something just get a fix out of it. So the structure of people actually care about you was hard for me to accept. But then as soon as I tried to do it the other way, like really care if somebody was in a meeting or if somebody shared or if somebody didn't drink, like I looked around the room and I just saw people's faces as like holy. It was like not in a like formed religious sense, but it was like, how did they do that? How did they get here? What's the probability that all of them are not dead too? Like I pretended like I was dead and then I wanted to be dead and then I didn't want to be dead. And here I am in a meeting. Holy cow. an amazing progression to me and something that I just had no idea how to process. And then I started caring like a little bit. Remember they say, we're gonna love you until you learn how to love yourself. So I had like work to do, like everything was freaking work. And I had to really be serious about this because the self-deception part, like the like getting off of the treadmill kind of thing is so easy for a cat. I don't know. I like for a person who likes their comforts and their luxuries and you know, for pleasure as I do, right? Like it's very easy to stop doing good habits. Mitch Hedberg, comedian, said it's as easy to start flossing as it is to quit smoking, right? Like good habits are not natural. And so to be shown love and care and then to be able to give it back. I ran with a new crowd of like incredibly beautiful women who were beautiful to me. And we would do all sorts of healthy, sober things like yoga and retreats and walks in the woods and climbs up mountains. And we would have like a pagan women's meeting up on a mountaintop and we would have like the equinox together. And we became like very woo-woo. And as some of you know, like, you know, I do tarot and meditation. I was somebody like, if anybody ever tried that 5 minutes or sorry, 30 seconds of sitting with just your thoughts and breathing, like I had a director once, I was in 12th night in Santa Fe. And like I had a director who wanted us to breathe and I was like, bullshit. You know, I breathe when I'm smoking. come on. It's not, I was so resistant to things that were healthy or things that were nice because I thought that I would never be able to get my passions and like, you know, my gloriousness ever again. So I did not want serenity. I actually did come into these rooms going like, no, I think that every organized religion is anti-female. I think that it is bad to, like, it is what I do in addiction is to be stoic in my emotions or like, you know, reject my emotions. And there are like, you know, very helpful things that I've heard even concerning that. You know, I had this sort of Charles Schulz scene of how we treat our emotions and like, you know, is it like kicking the football? It's when if a child came up to you crying and wanting something and needing something, would you boot them? And that's the way that I dealt with my emotions. Is I did not caretake to finer parts of me. I rejected them like a child that was coming to me and crying. And it was powerful when I realized that that's not how my emotions were. You know, I thought that it was really cool to be hard, really good to be hard. I counted it once that it had been 7 years since I cried. And I tried so hard to just be, like to drink to sort of resist being drunk, did that kind of thing, like, you know, like very publicly tolerance filled. Like I would drink so that I could resist how drunk I felt. And so I had a tremendous amount of work to do trying to make my life something that was like could be stitched into some sort of semblance of a life. Because I mean, they say you come in with the gift of desperation, and that's such a great gift. But every time I'd have to reset the day and tell myself, like in Zen Buddhism, as soon as you've got the idea, the master will like, I have time to tell you this story. I was in Japan with a group of students that I brought over in a world religions class. I was with this great kid who's on the spectrum, very concrete thinker. And we were looking at this statue called the Nine Stones in Kyoto or something. And if you go from one angle, you can see eight stones. If you go from another angle, you can see a different eight stones, because one stone like includes another stone by the way that they're set up. So we're looking at this, we're contemplating this together. And like I'm having this like great Zen epiphany. And I go, wait, I'm the ninth stone. I take my experience from like here to here, and I carry that stone with me, and I'm having like this Zen moment of enlightenment. And this kid, like with his backpack, hits me with his backpack and goes, think again. And the master, they will hit you with the Roshi stick when you think that you've gotten too comfortable, when you think that you've got it. And that was the moment as a teacher where I realized that, like, you know, the Ronin had really become the master, because there's so much that I think that I'm having this great epiphany, I'm having this amazing experience, like, oh wow, couldn't get any better. And it's good to be hit by the backpack, because then I get to think again. I'm not stuck, I'm not baked, I'm not done. If I had only the tools that I had 5 years ago, it would be, I would have nothing. If I had only the tools that I have today, I would have today. So I mean, like it's really, really, really easy for me to see that recovery is how I can start to, like is the only thing that will give me a life. That much is pretending and misery and sets me down a dark path. And today I want something else. And that's a really hard trick for me. Like I'm codependent and from system of control, and it's very hard for me to figure out what I want, and I'm really terrible at making decisions. So if any of you are involved in my decision making, I apologize to you in advance. Just like take the reins when we are parking or when we need to like pull the trigger on something, because I can't do it. I will sort of vacillate and get scared and like, you know, flake out. So now you know me. But the idea that I can build this into a life, that I can do something that it isn't how I thought, and then now think again, oh wait, no, it wasn't what I thought. It's all this lovely improvisational yes and should find it, because I like the idea so much. But it's how that woman who brought me to recovery ends one of her books, is on this Rilke concept, that there's nothing that you can do, there's no art that you can do so perfectly. You know, we say there's only one step that you can do, and that's the first step, and it's the only one that you can do perfectly. And perfect, I don't like, it means that, you know, it's done, it's the end of it. There's only one thing that you can, there's only one art form that you can do perfectly, like unarguably, and that's to live one's life as a work of art. So that's what we do here. That's what this experience is for me, is ever-changing. It's a beautiful little chimera. But I had a lot of pain, and I'm learning how to make friends with that pain, or see that pain differently, or take that pain out to coffee. I think it even drinks coffee differently than I do. I like it black. I think my pain has my coffee with all sorts of other things in it. But yeah, I want to figure out what little steps I can do today to live this life as a work of art. And the main way that I've learned through all of this is caring about you, is thinking about other people, and getting to be able to come to a meeting and getting to be part of a fellowship. And that's what I would be losing if I drank today, because I would be losing all of your stories and all of your strength and everything that just fortifies me. So I apologize if there's been any technical difficulties, but I'm very happy to end my talk now, just sort of thinking of you. And thank you, Megan, and thanks for the 11th hour and everything for it to have been working out. Take care. Thanks.